Welcome to House of Comments. I'm Charlotte Henry and she is Emma Bunnell. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Charlotte.
Right, forgive me, Em. The first 5 minutes of the show are going to be a bit of a therapy session. Let's start with the first thing. First of all, you may notice that our lovely little podcast is rather unique.
Yeah,
it increasingly stands alone because Emma and I are both female. Now, every time I turn on Twitter or which is not very often these days, or look at an email or something, there seems to be, how can I describe this politely? Two white men of often a certain vintage.
Be fair, at least one of them's not white.
Yes, there is one occasion where that's true, yep. Chatting to each other about politics, deciding we need to hear their voices, and some of those shows are interesting, sure. But we'd like to bring a bit of girl power to the political discussion. So, and this is a serious plea, actually. We love doing this show, but it does need some support and some backing. So if you like listening to us every week, and we really hope you do, please do share the show, tell people about it. Make sure you're following in the podcast app you listen to us. Leave comments. It all helps promote the show. And never mind that Emma and I also really enjoy hearing from you. So that is a sincere start to the show, because it's quite exhausting to see all these men getting the big bucks and the big contracts to have these conversations when, frankly, Emma and I are funnier and better looking. So
you are.
Our appearances don't matter on podcasts anyway, but we...
Yeah, let's not go down the route of judging women's appearances this week.
Oh, yeah, God. We'll come back. We won't come back to that. We've got too much again. But sincerely, you know, Emma and I did this not just because we're mates and we like talking about politics, because we could do that in the pub very, very happily and do. We do it because we think we need women's voices in the political discussion. So we do appreciate you all listening and would love any shout outs, any supports to help us grow our show and give these men a run for their money.
And I think also what's really important is that we're two women who disagree a lot.
Yes.
Because so much pressure on female-led podcasts for it all to be totally positive. We love each other. We're wonderful. Everything's wonderful. And I think what we offer is the fact that we have very different perspectives on a lot of things and have no problem with having those arguments.
No, and I think that comes from a place of genuine friendship. I consider over the years you've been a wonderful layer of support and friendship and encouragement to me. I hope you feel the same the
Absolutely.
Other way around. But yes, we won't do the women lovey-dovey thing, but it does matter to have female voices in politics. So do share, give us a shout out and keep listening, because we really, really do appreciate it and want to give these men a run for their money. Right. This is the second part of the therapy session, Emma. Ed Davey, the Lib Dem conference. Now, we'll do more in-depth special episodes for covering the Labour and Conservative conference, but we do need to mention the Lib Dem conference, probably the SNP conference as well, at the points they happen. Particularly with the Lib Dem conference, obviously the big thing that came out of it and was the whole theme throughout was the Lib Dems have nailed their colours to the mast and said, get the Tories out. That's what we'll do in government. We'll never do a deal with the Conservatives this time around. That's what it's about. Okay. I don't quite know. I've felt very conflicted about the whole thing. I've felt conflicted about the NIMBY, anti-NIMBY debates that they had within the Lib Dems, because I'm pretty anti-NIMBY.
Yeah.
I feel a bit conflicted if Ed Davey is basically saying we are the Progressive Alliance, because if you're just an extension of the Labour Party, I don't really know what the point of view is as a Liberal Democrat party. And you and I have discussed this before, haven't we? And actually you and I prove it every week on this show. The Liberal Democrats and Labour Party are very different. They come from very different political traditions. They have, or should have, very different political worldviews. So just creating this generic anti-Tory coalition is feels a bit meh to me. What's your take?
It's a really interesting question. For me, the big difference between the parties is that Labour essentially leads with its economic analysis, and the Lib Dems essentially lead with their social analysis. So there is within the Labour Party, even though there are differences in how hard, how fast, how far you might take a left-wing economic agenda, there aren't many people in the Labour Party who could be described as on even the centre-right economically.
Economically, no, that's true.
However, Labour membership, voters, voting coalition absolutely straddles and it runs right across the divide in terms of liberal authoritarian values. And Labour in government has done things that I would consider to be too authoritarian, things like 90-day detention, for example.
ID cards?
I'm a little more ecumenical on ID cards. I don't have a problem with them so much ideologically. I just don't think they're ever going to do the job that every time they get proposed, they're proposed to do something different. And I never think they're going to actually do the thing that they're proposed to do. But
you can probably imagine my view.
That is a something where the Lib Dems might be considered that to be, even my view, to be too authoritarian. So I think that in terms of that Progressive Alliance, and I don't believe in the Progressive Alliance, I firmly take the view that all parties should run in all seats, blah, blah, blah. I'm not anti-electoral reform. It's just never going to be in my top 100 things to do. But in terms of where the two parties could have an... The Lib Dems are not going to be the party of government. They're just not.
Standing on their own.
That was a terrible, stupid thing to say, and a really bad strategy.
Interesting. So I'll jump in here and remind people. I interviewed both Ed Davey and Joe Swinson when they were running against each other for the leadership when Joe Swinson won. And they both said to me, they wanted to be prime minister. If you listen to my episode over the summer with Mark Pack, he said, I think Ed Davey's not going to say that this time. And indeed, he hasn't. And I think your analysis is right. The social, because the Liberal Democrats are, or certainly were, in the time that I was active within the party, which is a number of years ago now, there's still quite a wide spectrum of economic beliefs. There are people like me that come from the traditional classical liberal tradition, your smaller state, smaller tax, that kind of thing. And obviously, Sir Nick Clegg, Danny Alexander, David Laws, those people came from that tradition as well and were therefore able to do a deal with the Conservatives. One might argue that Ed Davey at some point was from that tradition as well. I would let him answer that question for himself. He obviously was, and this is a really part of this conversation. It's really important. He was obviously a very senior Secretary of State in that coalition government, and that I suspect is worth remembering as this conversation inevitably continues. So there's all of that. But you're right, most Liberal Democrats would agree on most social issues in the more liberal tradition. So ID cards, most Lib Dems would care about electoral reform to a lesser degree or the other. Most Lib Dems would care about, well, gay marriage, you know, all these kind of more socially liberal things would unite most Liberal Democrats. I think you're right about that. Whereas the economics thing would be more of the debate.
And I think what was interesting, and I wrote about this a while back, the Lib Dems had a choice to make when they were choosing between Ed Davey and Leila Moran, because they're a very, very middle class party. I mean, most parties are a bit middle class, but they're very middle class. And they have no class based analysis at all. That's not what the Lib Dems are for. What they were choosing between were two very distinct flavors of middle class. whether you wanted urban, identitarian middle class liberalism, you voted for Leila Moran. If you wanted rural, we just like to be a bit nicer to each other, middle class liberalism, you voted for Ed Davey. And I think they made the right choice for the party. because if you look at the seats that they're targeting, you know, they're looking at taking Tory seats.
For sure. And Davey, I listened to him on talking to Lewis Goodall on the news agents, and he made the point that he has always, by definition of his seat in Southwest London, has always taken on Conservatives. That's what he can do. That's
yeah,
what he gets.
And I think, you know, the way that the electoral makeup of the country has changed significantly. It used to be that there were a lot more Lib Dem Labour marginal seats, and there just aren't anymore. I think there's like one or two in the top 50 target seats for the Lib Dems, and that's it. Obviously, at the moment, they're all fighting over mid beds,
sure.
But that is a rarity. Yeah. And in terms of where they're going to put their time, energy, and resources at a general election, there will be target seats. And they won't be almost completely fighting each other.
Yes. But we do need to wrap up on this because we've got so much to get through today. But there's one thing I will say, because it's easy to say, oh, the Lib Dems don't matter. And maybe in the end they won't. Maybe in the end they won't get enough, take
it's
out enough.
It's easy, Charlotte. It's incredibly pleasurable.
Sure. But it might end up in the case that they don't take out enough Conservatives. They don't really add too much to the count. And so Ed Davey just remains on the back, you know, as an opposition leader. I assume he would continue after a general election if the Lib Dems added to their seat cushion. If nothing else, I'm not sure who the hell would take over from him. But you could also be in a situation where Sir Keir Starmer doesn't get the 126 or whatever it is new MPs that he needs and does need to do business. It's huge. It is absolutely huge. And I think people, when they look at the polls, are really underestimating what it means in practical terms.
Yeah.
So there is a number of situations in which Sir Keir Starmer and Sir Ed Davey have to do business one way or the other.
Yeah.
And I can sort of see them for maybe reasons we don't particularly like, but are typical of our politics. You can see them being two men that could do business together.
Yeah, I think it would be confidence and supply rather than a formal coalition. I think the Lib Dems got too badly burned. They got played.
Got some things they wanted done, but yes, it has the ramifications for years and years and years have been terrible for the Liberal Democrats. Be the best part of a decade at the next election.
Ramifications. If you look at what the Conservatives did in the way that coalition government was designed, they dipped the Lib Dems' hands in the blood.
Correct.
Let's
just be clear about this, because this is a really important point. That was also the choice of the Liberal Democrats to make sure they owned every decision.
Yeah, but it wasn't just that. Look at who they put where.
Correct.
They put Vince Cable in charge of tuition fees.
Correct.
Yeah, you know, they wanted to put a Lib there, and the Conservatives were utterly ruthless on that.
Yeah.
And I think the Lib Dems were too, I think the personal chemistry between David Cameron and Nick Clegg made them too blind to how much they were being snowed.
Yeah, and I think actually it's probably not a bad thing then that the leader, current leader of the Liberal Democrats, was in that government and saw it in behind the scenes. So anyway, yes, I believe that those two, so Keir Starmer and Sir Ed Davey, could do business together. And I suspect we're going to have keeping this conversation when it starts to dawn on people, particularly people, you know, some political journalists actually, who just look at the polls and go, oh my God, the Labour are on their way to victory. That we're going to have to think about this a lot more. Thank you for that therapy session. Right. We have a lot more to be getting through because this is another, I might need a therapy session after this. Suella Braverman headed over to the States to talk to a conservative right-wing think tank to talk about migration and the UN Convention on Rights for Refugees and so on. And I'm sorry, it was utterly, utterly depressing. We can have, or we should be able to have, serious conversations about migration, but first of all, it has to be based on reality. Some of the things, like the idea that a billion people would come over here saying again, like, is obvious nonsense. We don't need to spend time discussing it because it's obviously nonsense. And I just found, I'm very conscious of saying this, I'm going to put my words very carefully as a white woman making this point, but I find it, and I have been quite clear actually in other points, that I don't like this idea that often I think people on the centre-left do, that if people are not white, they're sort of one of theirs, if you see what I mean. I think that does happen in some parts of the left. But what I find utterly depressing is that a government that has put in power the first Hindu prime minister, has therefore got three of the four great offices of state are people of colour, and presumably, and they do have, you know, immigrant backgrounds within their families.
Yeah.
I find provoking this debate so depressing. Does that make sense, or am I being a bit...
No, it'd be depressing whoever Suella Braverman.
Correct.
And whoever Rishi Sunak was.
Actually, I'll tell you what it is. And Hugo Rifkind, the Times columnist, put this really well. He said, and I'm going to read his whole tweet, if you forgive me. Remarkable to hear Braverman say multiculturalism has failed. She's a British Home Secretary descended from Goan Indians from Mauritius and Kenya, married to a Jewish husband in a government headed by Britain's first Hindu PM. What would successful multiculturalism look like?
Absolutely. And she's also, I mean, she's clearly just positioning for the Tory leadership.
One assumes so.
And this is who she thinks the Tory members are. I mean, I'd be quite insulted if I were a Tory member, but then, you know, be a Tory member. But I mean, she's also just lying about stuff. The Mail on Sunday has been forced to issue a correction over opinion piece that she issued, which said that almost all child grooming gangs were British Pakistani. It's at the Home Office's own figures say that they're majority white. So it's, yeah, it's just, she's just not only dog whistling, but dog whistling with lies. There is a great deal of difference between, let's have a sensible conversation. We are a country with borders. How do we manage that? Who can we take in? How many can we take in? How do we process that? How do we make those decisions? How do we integrate people who come to live here, to make sure that they're able to live full and productive lives? All things that are perfectly within the realm of respectable discussion.
Yep. Sorry, not only respectable, but very, very important for a functioning democracy to have those discussions.
Absolutely. But just plucking a figure out of the air and saying, this is how many people could come, hint, hint, they will, yeah, unless we do stupid things like leaving the ECHR, is deeply irresponsible.
It is irresponsible.
And the worst part for me is that it then makes having the better conversations harder, because you sound too much like Suella Braverman if you say, how are we going to manage the border?
Yes. Which, as I say, is a legitimate and important conversation for people in politics to have.
Yeah.
But I just want to go back to this point about multiculturalism, because, you know, she said as the Home Secretary that multiculturalism has failed. I don't believe that in Britain. I appreciate that my view is slightly different because I walk around London, which obviously is thriving with multiculturalism, and it's one of the reasons I love living in this city. But also, and I was a bit apologetic in my tone when I was commenting on what she said, but equally, you know, I might be white, but I also have you know, I come from a Jewish family who not that many generations ago were not in this country and assimilated into it, and that is also a form of multiculturalism, and it's important that, like, we understand that that hasn't failed. That's important. And multiculturalism, I feel very strongly, is one of Britain's biggest advantages, and one of the things that makes Britain can make Britain a very strong country if we do it right and respectfully. And for the Home Secretary to be saying those things is just utterly depressing.
Yeah, and she also lumped together a whole bunch of cities.
Yeah.
So London, Paris, I can't remember what the third one was, that take completely different approaches to multiculturalism. So the idea that there is one multiculturalism, and this is how it works. The UK and France could not be more different in how they approach these things.
What, so?
So, you know, again, it's just, it's stupidity wrapped up as, hey, I'm going to tell you the truth. And it's just vile. I'm going to use that word again, vile.
Yeah. And it is an interesting thing. Let's talk about the raw politics. Let's not just be utterly depressed about what it means and what it says about, you know, her. Do you think it is, you said it's a play for the Conservative leadership. It's hard to see anything other than that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that the current Conservative leader allows her to jet off to make these speeches. Where's the sign off? Because
it was signed off. It was signed off by Number 10. This is worth remembering. Rishi Sunak is not the sweet, nice guy that he tries to portray himself as. I mean, he's gone completely down a rabbit hole recently. Apparently, he's going to buy in to the 15-minute cities conspiracy theory in his conference speech we've heard today. That's bonkers.
Yeah, but it will be interesting to see.
He's not just leaning into the right of his party. He's leaning into the reality-denying right of his party.
Well, we'll obviously have to see what he says about that. I mean, even the fact, even if he doesn't say it on stage, the fact that that's sort of been shown a bit of leg in public is somewhat telling. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
Recent, you know, we're scrapping net zero.
Well, sorry, he didn't say that.
No.
They changed some of the plans while saying we will still be on track for net zero by 2050 / it's not my problem anyway in a little bit.
But yeah, it's all wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I'm Jeremy Clarkson, really. And it's just so weak. I mean, I know that's the attack line I'm supposed to use as a Labour supporter. And I wouldn't if I didn't think it, because I do try not to take my line directly from Labour Party press office. But he just does seem to have no control and no plan and no direction and no ability to get a grip.
I mean, it does feel like, well, actually, I said this before, and when we discussed net zero last week, I think what happens is every time he thinks he's getting a grip, there's something sort of goes wrong. It doesn't quite work. So that net zero stuff, he thought he was stamping his authority on it. But the problem was the stuff he was talking about was nonsense from the footnotes of reports that was never going to happen in the first place. And that obviously is a bit what happened with Braverman's speech as well, that she wanted to look tough, but used numbers that were in no way based on reality.
No, and they were from a report written by Nick Timothy. If you're taking your advice on how to win an election from Nick Timothy, who, let's remind ourselves,
I was going to say that went well last time.
Behind Theresa May's campaign.
Yes, that went well. Anyway, well, perhaps then all of this is at least part of the reason why Alex Sharma has decided he is jumping ship. He obviously led COP26 and announced this week that he will not be standing. It would be a new seat that he would have to fight, but he's decided he will not be standing for election again. I don't know if Rishi Sunak will think this is a particular blow or not. It's another senior Conservative standing down, which never looks good. Obviously, someone would have to make such a decision because of, you know, the new seats and a bit of a rejig. I wouldn't think it's exactly the type of person you want to lose, though.
Well, and also he said quite explicitly that his intention is to spend his time between now and the end of the parliament campaigning on green issues.
Correct.
At the same time as the government's done this U-turn. So, yeah, I think that the timing was not accidental.
No, of course it wasn't. And there's been various MPs over the last few months. I'm thinking back to the show where Sajid Javid resigned while we were sort of live recording. Yeah. Thank you very much. But Sir Alex Sharma obviously has committed himself to the green agenda feels obviously that this government is, or I would guess he feels that the government is not doing enough on a thing he cares about that makes it worth him hanging around. He's going to stay and campaign on it from the back benches for the time. And I just think losing people like him just consistently looks like a bloke that I don't pretend for 1 minute that people walking up and down the street are going, oh my goodness, Alex Sharma is not Sandy again. The Conservatives are doomed. I don't think that's reality at all. But it continues to provide a sense within the party itself that everything is sort of coming to an end in this cycle.
Yes, yes. It's very fantasy-ish.
It does start to feel like that.
And
it feels like very end times.
Again, because we're openly talking about the fact that Braverman is positioning herself for the next leadership contest.
Sure.
You know, the conversation is nearly always about the Conservative Party in opposition after the next election.
Yes, they won't say it out loud, but that's it, must be the reality. And I suspect if you and I were sitting having coffee and drinks with people involved in the Conservatives and Conservative politics, and they were being honest, that's what they would be talking about.
But that is what happens when I have coffee and drinks with those
people.
There
you go. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And I haven't heard a Conservative voice actively say in private, we can win the next election. They'll say it on the telly because they have to, it's their job, but they will not say it in private because they don't want to look stupid.
Yeah, and like they see the numbers, they know the writing's on the wall. It brings us back to our question about the Liberal Democrats and Labour. At, you know, the Conservatives are feeling the pressure in certain parts of the country from the Liberal Democrats. There is the distinct possibility with the Liberal Democrats' ability to target that they can take out enough Conservatives to cause a problem for the Conservatives and make Labour have to do business with them. And I think the conversation is happening, you know, again, from that conversation on the news end. And I think it's true. The Liberal Democrats do better often when Labour is doing better, because there's some seats where people feel they are able to vote Liberal Democrat because it's not going to provoke a Conservative government.
Yeah. Yeah, and they, if they're not frightened of Keir Starmer.
So people are not frightened of Keir Starmer, that's right.
Them in order to get, and that resulting in Keir Starmer being Prime Minister.
Right. Yeah. Bringing it back to Sir Alex Sharma, as we say, people are not walking up and down the street talking about him standing down, but it does tell us something about the Conservative Party. And it, again, reiterates, I would suggest, the damage in some quarters, because there are some people who are very happy about it. There is some places where moving away from being green has done the Conservative damage. It's undone a lot of work they did over a number of years.
It happens every time, doesn't it? You know, David Cameron changed the logo to a tree. We're going to be green, hug a husky. And then, you know, 2 years later, it's get rid of the green crap.
And then Boris Johnson came in, tried to, you know, because Carrie told him to care about the green stuff. And then that was a big thing. And now it's sort of gone back again. Look, there is a whole different conversation. We'll have to do it on another show, that people like green stuff till they have to pay for it and see it in their bills. And I think that is a real thing.
Yeah. It is really hard. And I don't think it would be that much less hard if we weren't in a cost of living crisis, frankly. But no. When the rubber hits the road, it is harder.
Sure.
And there are ways and ways of doing these things. But part of the problem is 13 years of underinvestment in infrastructure.
Let's finish off talking of infrastructure. Is that they've announced Rosebank, it will happen. This is the oil field.
Yes.
Now, of course, some people are delighted about this. It's our own energy. It's our own security. Obviously,
we're probably going to export most of it.
That may well be the case. Obviously, the line the government is taking is that we're using it for ourselves. Rishi Sunak said, yes, we should drain every last drop from the North Sea because it's ours. okay. And obviously green campaigners are obviously horrified by this move. So it's also caused ructions, obviously, in Scotland.
Yeah, because... which is interesting. Like, Hamza Youssef has come out against it.
Yep.
Interesting, because in 2014, an awful lot of the economic case put forward for independence was about using North Sea oil.
Correct. That's where they
get their economic case from if they're not going to use North Sea oil.
Well, it was a huge part of how they were going to finance basically everything.
Yeah.
So, and this is all very interesting ahead of a by-election on Thursday, which it's assumed up in Scotland that Labour will win.
What I'm hearing on the ground is Labour are very bullish. You know, the canvassing returns are very, very good. Nothing, you know, nothing is certain until it's done and the last vote is counted. But definitely the mood music that's coming out of the seat from Labour activists. And I don't mean the Labour activists who are just going to always tell you that Labour are going to win. I'm, you know, I'm talking to realistic Labour activists here.
Yeah, the people that only canvass Labour seats already.
And people who, no matter what you tell them on the doorstep, will go back to the board runner and say, oh, yeah, they're definitely voting Labour. I was speaking to someone, you know, really knows, really understands Scottish politics, who was telling me that this is the, you know, it really is the best that they've felt since 2011 on the doorstep. And it's like a sea change. And interesting, so I asked whether it was just a Margaret Ferrier thing.
Yeah, and then, just remind us, in case people have forgotten, what's the Margaret Ferrier story?
So Margaret Ferrier was the MP for the seat. Rutherglen and Hamilton West, is that right?
Sounds right.
And
let's go with it.
She got COVID.
And let's just remember what
COVID
time.
In Glasgow. This was when tests took 5 days, went to London before the test results came in.
Oh, yes.
Was in London when she was pronounced positive. And at that point, you were supposed to isolate while you were waiting for your test results. She went to London to Parliament. Then the result came back positive, and she took a train back to Glasgow.
And let's remember, this was very, very early on in the pandemic where people were really scared, didn't know much, really upset about this.
And incredibly, observing of the rules. You know, the British, what people who make a lot of noise about lockdown forget is that the British public basically locked down before the government told them to.
Correct.
Things were closed a week or so at least before the official...
And people had made their own decisions about where they were comfortable going or not.
And so she was fined. There were various measures. The measures were strong enough for her to be subject to a recall petition, which passed easily. And that's why there's a by-election and she's not... I think she was kicked out of the SNP. And so she's not their candidate. But because there had been so much scandal around her, the question I asked this person I was speaking to was, is it just a Margaret Ferrier issue?
Yes.
Or the malaise with the SNP deeper? And again, this is not someone who would tell me what I wanted to hear or put a positive spin on it. And she said, no, it is deeper.
I'm going to be a little...
question is just as strong as ever, but the SNP are no longer seen necessarily as the vehicle for government.
Interesting. So I'm going to be a little bit more cynical. And if we wake up on Friday morning and sit down to record this show and Labour have won, which if you gave me 10 quid to bet on, that's what I would bet on, a comfortable Labour victory in that seat. I don't think yet it tells us that much about how people in Scotland feel about the SNP. I think it tells us a hell of a lot about how angry people in that seat are about Margaret Ferrier. I'm not yet convinced that that is totally indicative.
As I say, that's not the message that's coming back.
Yeah, no, I understand that. But I think we would be jumping to slightly too early a conclusion. I still think the SNP are in massive trouble generally. I'm not sure this result is going to tell us that, confirm that for us.
I think it will be an indicator. I don't think it's, you know, the be all and end all, but it's definitely an indicator. And it will depend on what the margin is.
Yes, I could be persuaded it depending on the margin. That's fair enough. All right, well, we've got through a hell of a lot this week, and we'll definitely be back to talk about a bit of a preview of Labour conference, I would imagine, next week. We'll talk about this by-election result. There'll be a lot to get through. So we will see you next week. But where can people keep up with you, Emma, in the meantime?
I'm on all of the platforms, usually as Emma Burnell _. And I also have a newsletter called Hard Thinking on the Soft Left on Substack.
I'm at Charlotte A. Henry across social media, or at Char A. Henry. And head over to theaddition.net or newsletter.theaddition.net to keep up with my blogging, newsletter, all that, podcasting, all that kind of thing. Please, as I say, it really matters that you share, follow this show wherever you listen to podcasts. We really, really appreciate it. And do give us a tweet as well over at HOC Podcast, because we do love to hear from you. And we will see you next week.